From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Monday, December the 2nd, 2019. And if you wonder where the heck November went, November was kind of confusing, I thought, this year with Thanksgiving coming so late. 28th it was last Thursday, and so just a couple days left after Thanksgiving in that month, and boom, November or December, here we are. And just what is it, 3 weeks or so till of shopping left for before Christmas. I haven't even started yet. Is anybody else out there ahead of me? I bet you most people are. But Dana, what about you? Are you all done with your Christmas shopping already? Are you Mr. Efficient?
Well, I've thought about it several times now, and that's pretty good. That's better.
I've thought
than
about
you.
It a couple times. Yeah.
So fun to think about.
Yeah, it's a good thing to think about. Hey, we have a good show lined up for you this morning. Colin Mine's going to be my first guest. He's managing editor of etdigger.org. And one of the stories of Colin and I are going to be talking about is Vermont's homeless population. We seem to be growing in Washington County in that category, shrinking elsewhere. We're going to talk a little bit about that, and we're going to get some more, maybe a deeper dive on homelessness issues in the second hour, because Judy Joy from the Good Samaritan Haven in Barrie, a homeless shelter, actually a network of four, I think, homeless shelters it is, will be stopping by this morning to chat with us about what she sees on the ground in taking care of the area's homeless population. And so let's start out with Colin, who I believe is on the phone this morning. Good morning, Colin.
Morning, Dan.
It's Colin. And I hope you had a good Thanksgiving.
I did. A great one.
Excellent. Hey, let's get right into it. Bernie Sanders is getting sort of mixed signals from some of the national polls out there. What's Bernie seeing?
Yeah, so, you know, things up and down, and still very much a four-horse race, I would say, in the Democratic field. You know, he, in some recent polls, had topped the, was leading the polls in New Hampshire. He hasn't quite done that in Iowa, and then nationwide, Joe Biden has kept the lead. But, yeah, as you say, I mean, I guess at this point, it really depends on which poll you choose. I think the biggest trend that we've seen across the country is that Buttigieg, particularly in New Hampshire and Iowa, is really surging. And Elizabeth Warren, who seemed to be sort of headed to the top of the pack, has sort of trailed off a bit. But, you know, week by week, things are changing pretty fast. I think there's definitely some promising signs for Bernie, particularly the strong performance in New Hampshire. He's also rising a bit in some Iowa polls. But, you know, who knows what this week's polls will bring.
If Sanders and Warren don't finish in the first two places in New Hampshire, that will shoot my theory that New Hampshire has a strong preference for New Englanders. I mean, if you look back across the historical primaries in New Hampshire, it's really kind of amazing. I don't know if you ever recall the name. Well, you're from Maine. I'm sure you recall the name Edmund Muskie. Not a leading figure nationally, I mean, in terms of what people would remember now, but he actually won the New Hampshire primary in 1972 and then faded fast. Of course, he was from Maine. So, and then Paul Tsongas, another name most people probably have forgotten by now, but he won the New Hampshire primary in 1992. He was from Massachusetts. I was looking, and the only New Englander I could see losing was Howard Dean in 2004. He of course, lost to John Kerry from Massachusetts. So, yeah. It's just kind of amazing. I think the deal is that people found out that Howard Dean was originally from New York, and you got to be a Red Sox fan, I guess. You can't have any imposters or anything for New Englanders. But so that's the. It'll be interesting to see whether I bet either Sanders or Warren are probably destined for, and maybe both, for the top couple of positions in the New Hampshire primary. But of course, that's one round of this whole thing where some of it will they'll follow Iowa, so some of it will follow. Maybe there'll be some influence from momentum built out of Iowa, I suppose, and then it's on to South Carolina and Nevada and the rest of the country, really. So, but Sanders is looking like I guess it was the Emerson College poll that had him looking up now.
Yeah, so he was tied at 27% in the Emerson College poll, but then there was a Quinnipiac University poll the same day that had Biden at the top with Buttigieg and Warren and Sanders. So, you know, it really depends on which poll you look at. Another interesting tidbit out of the Bernie trail the past week was Politico did a deep dive into sort of former President Barack Obama's role, sort of candidates going to kiss the ring, as it were, at his house in Washington, D.C., and had advisors of the former president saying that he would sort of try to prevent Sanders' nomination if it looked like that was the direction things are heading in. I guess they're looking at the polls right now and thinking that Sanders doesn't have much of a chance with or without their help, but that sort of Barack Obama sees Bernie Sanders as a candidate that he does not want to see leading the Democratic ticket.
The Sanders went and visited with Barack Obama, as others did?
It's funny you ask. I don't recall in the story whether Sanders made that trip or not. I don't think he did, but I'm not sure.
I see. Okay. Well, so I don't know. That's a weird, I saw that too in Politico, and I was thinking, that's a very odd thing for Obama to put out there. I mean, especially at this early stage of what do you think? I mean, it just seems really odd to sort of threaten to, non-endorse somebody or whatever. Is he trying to kneecap him right now and hope he doesn't make progress in the primaries or what?
Yeah, I don't know. And, you know, you wonder what it really means when the person who he's going to face ultimately is Donald Trump. I mean, certainly, I would think that former President Obama would prefer a Bernie Sanders presidency to four more years of Donald Trump. So, you know, how bad he'd be willing to hurt any of the Democratic candidates, or whether or not it's sort of him putting this out there or advisors, going rogue, as it were. But yeah, I mean, and apparently has reservations about Warren as well, that they've sort of not gotten along terribly well politically. So, yeah, I mean, it seems like maybe President Obama would like to see his vice president out there, someone to carry on his legacy.
Yeah, I suppose that could be. He's just trying to smooth the road for Joe Biden. But, I must say, though, I think that Obama would probably have quite a bit of an influence, especially among African-American voters. I mean, if Obama comes out and says, we're not backing this guy about Bernie Sanders, that can't help, right?
Yeah, and the rise of Buttigieg to sort of challenge Biden, and you'd think that would have to carry on to Super Tuesday. He's doing really well in New Hampshire and Iowa. Mm-hmm. But among black voters, he is just absolutely abysmal. So in that sense, I think, the Obama-Biden sort of legacy is very strong and probably still puts Joe Biden in the leading position. For sure, although if he absolutely blows it in New Hampshire and Iowa, then, things could change pretty fast.
One of the raps on Sanders in 2016 was that he had some difficulty with African-American voters. And I'm just wondering, there was that famous confrontation in Phoenix where some Black Lives Matter activists basically stormed the stage during a Sanders rally and kind of took over the proceedings there. And Bernie was not a great sport about it. I mean, he just sort of seemed pretty awkward about the whole thing. And I guess that kind of didn't help in that year. Does he have some built-in problems with African Americans? I mean, he certainly has a pedigree that goes back to the famous march with Martin Luther King and all that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly not African Americans across the board. If you look at young sort of minorities, including African Americans, Bernie polls remarkably high, and that was mostly true in the last election as well. Mm-hmm. But then when you get to the sort of older segment, voters over 40, which are the vast majority of voters, then you see Joe Biden really start to take over when you do head-to-head polling of the Democratic candidates. And I don't know that Bernie's really made up significant ground. If you look at him compared to Hillary or him compared to Joe Biden this time around, it's hard to say. Certainly the campaign's made a huge amount of effort to do it. Nina Turner, who has been one of his sort of leading proxies this campaign, is also a co-chair of the campaign, and she's an African-American woman. You've seen some very sort of well-coordinated campaigning in South Carolina in particular, which is obviously sort of a bellwether for the minority vote in the mm-hmm. South.
Yep.
They put in a lot of effort, and perhaps, if it gets deep enough into the cycle, that will pay off. But when you look at sort of head-to-head polling, I don't think that he's made significant strides in gaining minority votes at least in South Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the tricks is sometimes you want to stop the bleeding, too. If you can do that, that can count as progress sometimes. So, hey, let's go to a couple of the other stories you listed for me in this morning as suggestions for stuff to talk about, and I really appreciate that, by the way, because VT Digger does have, I mean, you guys are covering the heck out of the national political scene and Sanders' role in it in particular because of his Vermont connection, obviously. But, you know, your in-state stories are really your bread and butter, and a lot of them are, you know, some of the best journalism going in Vermont right now, and it's a great thing. And one of the things you looked at in recent days was this feature of Vermont's older residents struggling financially. Your recent hire of Erin Petenko as data reporter, I think, was a really good stroke by Digger because she's doing a great job. Boy, she's really productive. I mean, she's putting out a lot of stuff, and she was a participant, if I recall correctly, in this one, right?
Yeah, she was, although the bulk of the work on this story was done by our politics reporter, Xander Landon, who took a day to be our elderly standard of living reporter.
Yeah, you need a break from politics every now and then, so why not?
That's right.
Yeah.
But a really interesting study out of the University of Massachusetts that showed that Vermont, you know, oftentimes you look at sort of poverty level and how many people of different segments of society are above or below the poverty line. And this study really took a more sort of holistic look at what's required in different states to get by and how does that compare to the average income of elderly residents. And Vermont was found to be near the top, at the top in some sort of indicators, but in the top three nationally as far as the number of the percentage of elderly people in the state who aren't making enough annual income just to meet basic standards of living. You know, that's food, health, housing, that sort of thing. And I think the two big drivers of that, one is that healthcare costs are the highest for that segment of the population of any state in America. Really remarkable, something like close to $600 a month being spent on healthcare costs compared to upwards 300, sort of 380 on average nationally.
Wow.
And then housing also very, very expensive in Vermont and not a lot of affordable housing options for people. So I think those two factors were cited most often as being the sort of drivers, and healthcare in particular.
Yeah, and one statistic I noticed in there that was kind of scary, I mean, it sort of made me think about my own situation when I retire and, you know, how much I'll have coming in from Social Security and et cetera. And the and that was that if you're a couple and your house is paid off, you're going to be needing about $41,000 in annual income, as I recall, to sort of meet your basic needs here in Vermont, and you know that's significant money for somebody who's not drawing a regular paycheck.
Yeah, and you know, despite the Associated Press and WDEV having made you close to rich man, you know, it runs out.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay. So, moving right along, let's see here. Whistleblower accuses OneCare of fraud, and I'm wondering, is there anything there, or is this a case where both the state and federal government looked at it and said, nah? I mean, it's hard to read these situations. This is one of these, what is it, QI-TAM case, I think it's called?
Yeah, I think false claims is the sort of underlying accusation here that OneCare, in the data that it's been submitting to regulators, both state regulators and federal regulators, basically has been knowingly submitting false data. That's the claim. Whether or not there's anything to it, I mean, certainly the narrative, you know, the whistleblower in this complaint sort of details, you know, this claim that OneCare has been submitting false data. And the narrative coming from the Green Mountain Care Board from OneCare at this point is that the fact that the district court decided not to pursue it, that the district attorney, Christina Nolan, sort of passed, is evidence that there's nothing to this. The lawyer that we spoke to representing, the name escapes me, Rob Hoffman, who made this complaint, says that, you know, this could there's other ways to sort of pursue this in court, and that it's not over yet. That you know, the fact that the U.S. attorney has decided not to pursue it at this point doesn't mean that it can't be pursued, and that there are ways to sort of you know, for private citizens to pursue these types of cases. Sort of what happens next in the legal process is hard to say. We weren't able to speak to Rob Hoffman about this, or rather he wouldn't speak on the record about his plans sort of going forward here. And, you know, sort of digging in to see whether there's any sort of evidence to support the claims about the data. I mean, the sort of, you know, it really would take something like a state auditor's office or the federal district court and that sort of thing to sort of figure out what's going on here and whether these claims are true. I mean, you know, we've sort of looked into getting some of this data on OneCare's patient population, and you know, it's possible it takes months to get access, and then it takes a team of sort of experts to really understand what all the numbers mean.
Yeah.
So it would require a large institution to sort of take this on and really take a critical eye to whether or not the data holds up under scrutiny.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of these types of cases in the past when I was working as a reporter for the Associated Press. And what happens is a whistleblower, oftentimes it's somebody who worked in a place, ended up leaving for whatever reason, is trying to point the finger at basically nefarious behavior by the institution the person was looking for. And so you look at it and you go, is this just a disgruntled former employee, or is this somebody who's got a real legitimate beef? Did the person get squeezed out or let go or whatever, you know, terminated because they were internally raising an alarm about something? So there's that whole line of inquiry. Another issue is, you know, sometimes the organizations that are being about which allegations are being raised are very powerful organizations in the state, and they end up getting, you know, you have to ask the question: are they essentially, you know, too big to fail kind of situation or whatever? I mean, is there some shyness by either the Medicaid fraud unit at the Attorney General's office, or by the U.S. Attorney's office, or whoever else the complaints are coming to really dig in and try to investigate, you know, or is the thing just fixated in the whistleblower's mind as a bigger problem than it really is? I mean, that's another. So they're very difficult to figure out from the outside, certainly, and even from the inside, and from a you know, an investigator's office, investigators having the power of subpoena in the case of state and federal authorities and so on. Still very, very difficult to get to the bottom of them. And so I guess we'll have to wait and see whether if this person does pursue a private claim, this Mr. Hoffman, which he's allowed to do under the law, you know, and you actually can, from what I recall, you can actually collect some of the proceeds if there ends up being some kind of a settlement down the road in which the institution was acting badly and has to make payments or something. You get a percentage. So,
again. Yeah, there's addressing a couple of those things. One is that, you know, Rob Hoffman, in this case, the complainant, says that he was terminated because he tried to raise these issues internally and was ignored.
Yeah.
May pursue a wrongful termination suit sort of separately from this false claims. And, you know, there was a sort of effort to make the Green Mountain Care Board, which is the healthcare regulator, the Attorney General's office, the Agency of Human Services, all of which are really the organizations that would be most damaged, I guess, by something like OneCare submitting false claims, and that all those organizations did not sort of agree to be what would, I guess, sort of be the plaintiff in this case. So, yeah, he would sort of have to go it alone at this point, and that is perhaps a tougher hill to climb.
Yeah, I mean, certainly if an institutional investigator like the U.S. Attorney's Office or the Attorney General's Office is, if it seems too steep a hill for them to climb, or you know, they don't see the payoff in an investigation at the end in terms of, you know, having a real impact or whatever, and you say, well, I can't devote that much staff time to it. I mean, I would imagine this person who used to work for OneCare probably needs to be out making a living himself right now. And you know, and this kind of work of digging into the data supporting a healthcare organization isn't simple stuff. You know, this is not something that you do in a half hour a day now and then. You know, it takes a lot of work to dig through records like that and and establish, you know, some kind of a pattern of abuse, if abuse in fact exists there. So I think, you know, I'm guessing the chances are definitely less than 50-50 here that he wins solo, but maybe he brings up enough stuff that he re-interests some of the officials down the road. That's another possibility. They could always jump in later. So
yeah, and it is also worth noting that the state auditor, Doug Hoffer, is currently sort of putting together a couple reports about where OneCare is at the moment. And, you know, I sort of wonder if there are really sort of gaping holes in the data or if there's clear sort of misreporting. You'd think that the state auditor's office would be positioned to pick that up. So it'll be interesting to find out.
Yeah, there's another possibility of you know, sort of an investigative arm that could actually reach out and come up with something on this. And so that's worth watching as well. So, hey, I wanted to, just in the few minutes we have left here, Colin, and dig in a little bit on this very good story that Digger had the other day. In dealing with the homeless population in Vermont, and weirdly enough, if I remember this correctly, the homelessness seems to be on the rise in Washington County and in decline elsewhere around Vermont. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, so we had one story about a week and a half ago about folks from Washington County, politicians, advocates, meeting and sort of talking about how there was a rising homeless population here, despite the fact that they had pledged to sort of, I think they were trying to eliminate homelessness in the towns around Washington County by 2020, and that clearly hasn't happened. But looking at statewide data, there's been a 30% decrease in homelessness, which seems to be a good thing. But a couple of our reporters, Aaron Patenko, our data reporter, he mentioned earlier, and Grace Ellison, who's our sort of government accountability reporter, called around to about 24 homeless shelters in the state, which to our understanding is basically that's how many there are in the state, to understand how many beds they had available, you know, as winter approaches. And it's just a mere fraction of the total population, something like upwards of 400 beds for something like 1,000 homeless people. Although the homeless population, it should be noted, fluctuates very much. There's not really a scientific way of tracking it. There are these things called point-in-time surveys that are voluntary and sort of give a general sense of what the homeless population is. But I think it's clear that there's not enough beds in the wintertime to accommodate. And anecdotally on the ground, that's also what we heard from the folks running these shelters.
Yeah, that is a... I mean, obviously the population's got to fluctuate somewhat, and I wonder if the, not just the population of the shelters and who's indoors and who's out of doors in the wintertime and so on, but does the homeless population in Vermont increase in the summer when it's warmer here and decrease in the winter when, if I were homeless, I might look to be moving south or something?
Yeah, I think that perhaps there's point-in-time surveys that would illustrate that. I think that it's definitely anecdotally true that, you know, you end up with a lot more people here during fair weather, and perhaps they head elsewhere when the weather heads towards
winter. Hello, Vichy Digger, can I help you?
And the I think we have somebody joining us on the line here, Colin,
okay.
But that's okay. This is the homelessness situation, though, in why would it be increasing in Washington County and decreasing throughout the rest of the state? It seems like kind of an anomaly to me.
One of the theories that was put forward is that because Washington County has really focused on the issue and, you know, made sure that there are sort of accommodations, grants, and, you know, that sort of as the profile has risen that it's a place that really does care for its homeless residents, that perhaps that has led to an increase, although I'll note that some folks we've talked to don't feel that necessarily the institutions in Washington County are really looking out for the people they're caring for. But that was the theory put forward in the meeting in Washington County, was that people are aware that there are services here, and therefore when homeless people are sort of thinking about where they want to be, that factors into that decision.
And is there any sense of what the underlying sort of stressors are that are causing homelessness? I mean, is it purely housing affordability or lack thereof, or is it mental illness? Is it substance abuse? Is it what is leading more people to, at least in our area, in this central Vermont area where Washington County is located, to be living on the streets?
Yeah, I mean, certainly your guest coming on later in the show might have better sort of specific ideas of what's going on in this area. I mean, when we sort of talk to the state person in charge of sort of homelessness, you know, basically all those factors that you just described and more, I mean, you know, I don't think you can point to one thing sort of driving it. Certainly the opioid epidemic has manifested in various different ways, one of which being that sort of throws people out of their housing. There's very limited options for people who aren't sober as far as housing goes, so that's a sort of separate issue. But yeah, mental health, you know, lack of affordable housing, all those things. Certainly creating more affordable housing and sort of pathways to lead people from homelessness to affordable housing is one thing that people running these shelters talked about, really wanting the state to invest more in.
Yeah, and by the way, you you mentioned my guest later on in the program, and I will mention again, Judy Joy, who is executive director of the Good Samaritan Haven in Barrie, is going to be joining me around 10:15 this morning, I believe, coming in to talk about some of these issues affecting the homeless population in Washington County, which is, of course, Barrie is one of the principal towns of the of that area, and so. You know, I think that there are a lot of issues here and a lot of layers to kind of peel back on this particular onion. It's it is not an easy situation for anybody, including the folks who are homeless. And so it's interesting that folks are focusing on this now. Hey, Colin Mine, I'm going to wish you well for today and thank you very much for joining me. And we will be talking with you soon. We're going to go to some bottom of the hour news here from CBS, a couple words from sponsors, and we'll be back with more of the Dave Graham Show.
This is Jack from the Warren Store wishing you all a happy and healthy holiday season and asking all of you to shop local, eat local, and visit local. The days ahead are getting darker and it looks like winter is finally here. Give yourself the gift of a stress-free life by shopping, eating, and visiting local. Visit your friends, businesses, and restaurants and support their passion and performance. I know that they would love to see you. The Warren Store, where funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back for the second half hour of our program on this Monday morning, and want to open the phone lines for a little bit now and let the listeners out there, all you folks who want to weigh in on anything going on in the recent days in the news, et cetera, and tell us what you're thinking about the House Judiciary Committee, just for one example of news that is continues to unfold. This is the U.S. House Judiciary Committee. We have one in Vermont, but they are not doing anything with impeachment. The U.S. House Judiciary Committee is, in fact, it is starting hearings this week, picking up the ball handed off by the House Intelligence Committee. They had hearings there last couple of weeks, the 2 weeks before Thanksgiving, in which they heard from 12 witnesses, basically all telling a very similar story about President Trump pressing Ukraine for help in investigating Joe and Hunter Biden. Of course, Hunter is Joe's son. Joe is a key rival to President Trump in the 2020 election. The allegation, of course, being that Trump was asking for a renewed investigation of the Bidens. There was some investigation a couple of years ago that the Ukrainian authorities said determined there wasn't much there, and Trump was essentially pressing them earlier this year to say, let's rekindle that thing and see if we can basically dig up the dirt on the Bidens. And and that would be obviously useful to the incumbent president, who thought at the time, and this may still be the case, that the Democratic nominee could be Joe Biden, and it would be awfully handy to have some nefarious deeds uncovered in Ukraine around the time that Joe Biden was challenging Donald Trump for the White House. And so the ball has been handed off now from the House Intelligence Committee over to the Judiciary Committee, which is scheduled to start hearings this coming Wednesday. And it remains to be seen how long those will go or sort of what shape they will take. Will there be some portion of them that are conducted behind closed doors? And I just was chuckling a little bit because my good friend Dana Jewell here, who runs the board here at the station, while I take your phone calls, he passes them through, actually, and so on. He made a little prediction a few minutes ago, and He's pretty good. And this guy is a very knowledgeable and experienced radio man here at WDEV. So, hey, I want to bring a caller on the line here, Rama from Williamstown. Good morning, Rama.
Yeah, hey. So this impeachment thing, I with this whole deal with Trump and Ukraine, this is not a Putin-generated thing so much as a Putin-assisted thing. And we need to really be aware. Putin has been playing the last couple of presidents of ours, Trump and Obama specifically, for suckers. And they both have been played by Putin in some of the worst ways and have managed to do things that have been against the better interests of the country and the world. But, you know, Trump has let it out exactly what the Ukraine bit is all about and why it is such an impeachable offense. It's about him getting personal revenge against people who he felt personally slighted him in the run-up to the election. And he keeps going back to these op-eds, which never really attacked him, but just attacked went after some ideas, such as turning parts of Ukraine over to Russia. This whole bit about, you know, with Ukraine interfering with the election, it's all about Trump taking a personal slight. So all of his actions about Ukraine, and when you listen to the people that have been asked to carry out whatever ephemeral orders he's issued, have been about a personal slight from the Ukraine. It came out of the Ukraine government that Trump perceives as a personal slight. And that's why it's impeachable. Trump tried to use our national security. Trump tried to use our national government. Trump has attacked people, U.S. citizens. He's gone after them and cited violence against them, all because he felt personally slighted by Ukrainians.
You know, I've seen analyses in the past indicating that other presidents have had personal issues with the conduct of foreign policy, and one big one I recall, of course, is the George W. Bush allegedly. I remember reading analyses saying that he was trying to finish the project in Iraq begun by his father, and you know, that there was some filial connection there, and you can sort of psychoanalyze a president to the nth degree and try to figure out how the psychology ends up influencing our foreign policy or even domestic policy decisions. But here you think that it's more a matter of sort of personal pique and revenge as opposed to just the simpler analysis that says, hey, I want to get dirt on my opponent in the next election.
Well, listen, the attacks against the Ukrainian officials and against the lack of willingness to provide assistance to Ukraine, the shortest distance between two points for a narcissist is a personal slight.
Yeah.
That is
yeah.
the shortest distance between two points. Trump is a narcissist, beyond a shadow of a doubt. He's a classical narcissist. So for him, it's all about him. And the fact that he could go, and Giuliani had him going after to look for dirt to dig up on Biden, it's additional sugar on the ice cream cone for somebody like Trump. He thinks this is great. He not only can get back at people who he felt insulted him, but he can also get a leg up politically. So, listen, no, I think it all started from the personal slight that Trump felt.
Yeah, could very well be. I mean, certainly he responds to personal slights like no one else in American history, no leading politician, certainly, in American history. You know, usually the people are a little more subtle and they sort of think about it before they lash back at a personal slight. You know, how am I going to get this person down the road or whatever?
Well, we're not used to dealing with a clinical narcissist in the president's office. We're used to big egos there. Yes, you have to have I wouldn't say an outsized ego or anything, but you have to have a pretty solid feeling about yourself in order to get into politics at that level.
But yeah. Hey, Rama, one more question for you, which it just came up this morning as I was reading a piece in The Hill of sort of an analysis about the upcoming impeachment action in front of the House Judiciary Committee. And it begins this way. House Democrats plowing ahead with their impeachment investigation will enter the twilight phase this week when lawmakers begin to examine the most crucial question facing them to date. Do President Trump's dealings with Ukraine warrant his removal from office?
Yes.
You say yes.
Yeah, obviously. Anybody that's using the official work of the government to further their private and personal interests, yes.
Here's my problem with that approach to this story in the Hill today. It leaves aside all of the other stuff that, frankly, I'm a little shocked isn't getting any more play than it is in terms of the bills of particulars about this president. I mean, everything from paying off porn stars with campaign money to the emoluments clause stuff, where you know you got to stay at the guy's hotels in order to be in his good graces. And all of this stuff about that came out in the Mueller report, 140 something meetings between members of the Trump campaign and the Russians during the campaign, and then all of the instances that Mueller very clearly pointed out about obstruction of justice in the context of his own investigation. None of that stuff is even being mentioned these days.
So when you catch a serial killer, you put him in jail for the murders that you catch him at, or her, usually yeah. a him, and yeah. then you go after the murders they committed previously.
Well,
there you go. That's the way to approach it. I mean, Trump is such a serial abuser of our legal system, our political system. He is so blatantly illegal in so many things that he has done and continues to do that you can't possibly go chase after every last one of them all at the same time. It's impossible.
I think you could put a bill of impeachment together that could just very simply list those four different things.
Right. And then you can just see them. Listen, people would be jumping all over the place with a lack of attention and not being able to pick up on the details. No, I Nancy Pelosi has never been my favorite politician.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, she has handled, and Adam Schiff has handled this this whole impeachment inquiry very well.
Yeah.
And they've all right. taken a very slow, patient, let's investigate, let's get the facts, let's get something nailed down here. Then we can move on with other stuff if the need and the opportunity arises. But for now, you get the serial killer on the murders that you caught him at, and then once the serial killer is safely in jail and Trump's case safely out of office, once you got the serial killer in jail, then you go in and do the rest of the investigations, because you know that the serial killer cannot be out killing more people.
All right. Rama, thanks for the call. Good chatting with you this morning. Let's go to Fred in Newberry. Good morning, Fred.
Morning.
How you doing?
Pretty good. My opinion is that President Trump plunged a bayonet into the heart of political correctness.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to continue with another administration.
So, I'm sorry, say again?
You think this political correctness is going to fade away because Trump plunged a bayonet into the heart of political correctness?
Oh, you know, I don't really care about political correctness, frankly, Fred. I think that's a really boring topic, actually. I think people are way overplaying that, and it just doesn't make any difference to me about, you know, what is politically correct and what is not. I'm talking about criminality here. You know, it's a violation of the law to use campaign funds to pay off porn stars with whom you've had affairs. That's one. It's a violation of the law to allow foreign meddling in your election campaign. Now, you know, did foreign meddling get proven? I think when you have 140 meetings between, or you have 140 some odd meetings between the Trump campaign and various representatives of Russia. I mean, that's more meetings than I've had with a lot of people with whom you would say I had common purpose or I was colluding for a purpose. I mean, I used the example a few months ago on the show here in terms of how many meetings I've had with my doctor, you know, and you can collude for a good purpose. My doctor and I collude to try to keep me healthy, right? You know, but I haven't had 140 meetings with my doctor in the 30 years or so I've been going to the same doctor. Okay, so I just think by the sheer number of contacts there's something there. And then the fact that you have 10 or 11 instances, very well proven by Mueller, of obstruction of justice in the second volume of his report. You know, obstruction of justice is a crime. And my worry is, frankly, if we ignore all those prior offenses, it really is going to give a green light to future presidents who may not be as interested in, you know, wooing Ukraine to get dirt on his opponent, but maybe just stopping at using campaign funds to pay off women with whom you had an affair or you know, the other stuff on the list. And so, I mean, is all that stuff okay now? I guess that's my question. And it's not a matter of political correctness. It's actually a matter of obeying the law, isn't it?
Well, I suppose, but I think I honestly believe that the president is going to get impeached. But there's also a good possibility that he'll be found guilty, mm-hmm. and then there's this other possibility that Pence won't run for re-election, and Trump will throw his hat back into the ring.
Yeah, you know, anything's possible, and it could very well be that the American people like this kind of behavior. I mean, at some level, I'm not sure how that works, but I guess I was actually talking to somebody I'm quite close to the other day about this topic, and you know, if you feel like he's our guy, then you know I guess our criminal is better than the other party's saint. Maybe I don't know. You know, not to say the Democrats are all saints either, but I mean, you can look at the record of how many criminal convictions are connected with Republican versus Democratic administrations over the past 50 years. There's a big difference. You know, it's more than 100 to fewer than 10. So if
the president wins popular vote and the Electoral College vote, does that mean the country is full of racists, homophobics, and xenophobics? Does that mean that?
I am not sure. I'm not willing to go out and say that as much as I am really worried about what the president. I'm more worried about the president than I am about individuals who might have decided to vote for him. I mean, and I think in 2016 that one of the biggest problems for the Democrats was they did pick a nominee who really turned a lot of people off, and that being Hillary Clinton.
And, I agree with you there.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
Yeah. And so, you know, a lot of people were voting for Trump. I mean, I'm sure you talk to people, friends and family members and whatever, who said, you know, I'm going to vote for Trump because I can't stand her, basically.
Yep.
And
yep, I agree.
Yeah. And so what slice of the electorate did he pick up essentially because of her? I think that's a really important question the Democrats need to answer and figure out, how do we put somebody up who's just frankly not going to have that kind of visceral reaction from so many people, you know.
I think he got the forgotten man's vote, you know.
To some extent, yeah. I mean, I read a really interesting article in the Atlantic over the weekend, actually, about talking about the one of the big issues here, which is that the Republican Party's, according to this article, has become the white party. And there are, and demographically, the country is facing this point in its history when we're going to be majority non-white in the next 30 or 40 years, and that just scares the bejesus out of a lot of people.
I think that's interesting, because I looked it up on the internet. I can't remember whether it was Pew or whatever the institution was, but they said in 50 years, European Americans would still be in the majority. But the interesting thing is, you would have Asian Americans second, Mexican Americans third, and African Americans will still be in the low end of it.
Yeah, you know, I guess the question is, I mean, the numbers I've seen indicate that European Americans will not be in a majority. They may very well be in a plurality for a while. In other words, they don't have a majority, but they have the largest share. If you slice it all up that way, but if you say that, if you just break it down in terms of the white versus non-white, that non-white will have a majority by, you know, certainly by 2050 in the United States, and that change, that sense of how our country is changing, really does put a lot of people on edge. And, you know, when we were kids, Fred, you and I, it was just sort of the norm in America to be white and Christian, you know, and that's becoming less of a dominant type, really.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, but you know, when you talk about white and so on and so forth, I was brought up in New Hampshire, and you mm-hmm. know, there weren't very many blacks in New Hampshire when I was brought up.
Right.
I don't know about Vermont, but I imagine there weren't many in Vermont either.
No, Northern New England is all, I mean, we're all very, very small minority populations in this part of the country. But if you look at the... I mean, I remember just a few years ago, I was down in Boston. I was riding the subway, the T, and just, you know, in one of the cars between a couple, you know, maybe Boylston going over to the Government Center or something, or I don't. It was right downtown, is I guess what I'm saying. And I looked around on the subway car, and I was, as a white person, in the minority, definitely. And it sort of really hit me that day. I was just thinking to myself, wow, America really is changing. You know, there were a lot of people there who looked of South Asian extraction, of Indian or Pakistani, quite a number of African-American or maybe African immigrants or whatever, quite a number of Asians, and not as many as when I was growing up in that area as a kid. I'd ride the subway to go to a Red Sox game or something, and still a majority white crowd on the train, you know, So it is a changing demographic in America these days, and it's going to be it's making a lot of especially, frankly, a lot of white people nervous. Now, do I attribute that to racism and all this other stuff? I wish we could be a little more understanding than that. I wish we could be to try to educate people a little more gently, as opposed to just applying labels to them about the need to adjust to a much more diverse population in the country.
Do you think the millennials are going to have a major position or a major part of this presidential election?
Millennials being what, the folks who who were born in the late 80s and 90s and stuff, or what do you mean?
Yeah, right. They're old enough to vote now.
They're
in probably the majority now, really, when you come down to it.
It could very well be.
Are the old people going to vote like they always do? You know, the old people have always been the ones that would swing an election because they voted. And the younger people are too busy doing something else.
I haven't been watching the polls that much of a fine tooth comb. I really can't predict. Obviously, young people tend to vote more liberal. So if you're a Democrat, I suspect you hope the young people turn out. And if you're a Republican, maybe you hope that they stay home and the old folks turn out. But
remember when I was 25, I was more interested in doing other things.
Yeah. Hey, Fred, I gotta move on, but I appreciate the call. Let's go to Dee in Duxbury. Good morning, Dee.
Hi. Good morning. I don't know how to say this. You know, I've called enough times. You know that my husband and I have brown children, mm-hmm. and we're white. And I don't see the, as you have defended people, I don't see the racism. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid of people with brown skin or different language or whatever. I'm just not.
Yeah, I get you, and I know other people who feel as you do, Dee. And I don't mean to imply that every white person has this fear, but I think that there's at some level a subconscious fear that is driving some of the political thinking in the country right now. And Trump very clearly represents, you know, when he says "Make America Great Again," he wants to basically put it back to a place where, you know, the classic American. If you said, you know, show me a picture of an African, I'm sorry, show me a picture of an average American, the person would be white and most likely Christian, and that was. That was just kind of the view of that folks had, and you know, I think. But let me ask you. Let me pursue this a little bit with you, Dee. So you have brown children. You and your husband are white. And are you supporters of this president?
Yeah, we voted for him.
Uh-huh.
My husband grew up in Baltimore. I grew up right outside of Washington, D.C., so...
Mm-hmm. And where, do you think you'll vote for him again?
Yeah.
You do?
I think he's doing great things for the country.
What do you have in mind?
What do you mean?
What's he doing that's great for the country?
I think he's bringing back manufacturing. I said to my husband this morning, it'd be nice if the first lady, who I think is beautiful, had a different accent.
Hmm.
I think that might help.
Why do you wish she had a different accent?
Yeah, if she had a Hispanic accent or an accent from Sudan or something like that.
Okay.
That would give him, I don't know, more of an in. He is rough. He is so New York. He's so rough. I mean, I get that.
Mm-hmm.
And I do not approve of everything he does. But you know what? I would not be voting and have not voted for a pastor. He's not my pastor,
mm-hmm.
or my priest, or my father, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
He's the president. I think he's doing good things for this country.
Well,
overall, I mean, again, I don't support every single thing he does, but
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we're doing really well. If you ever get a chance, look up Candace Owen.
Oh, I know that name. Yeah,
yeah. Well, she's from Connecticut.
Uh-huh.
She's black.
Yep.
She's a Republican, conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she's very smart.
All right. Well, Dee, thank you for the call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
And stay in touch. I like hearing from you. You have an interesting perspective on stuff. Hey, we got a minute to go here before the top of the hour. And one of the things I'd like to mention here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM, and that is our podcast. If you missed part of the show this morning, we had a really interesting conversation first half hour with Colin Mine, a couple of interesting calls just now from our regular telephone correspondence, let's put it that way. And if you want to hear all that, you can always go to our podcast, WDEVradio.com. And you just follow the link from there to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit, you'll come up with a list of our recent programs by topic and guest. And check it out. Thank the Warren Store, the funky, friendly, and almost world famous Warren Store for their help with the podcast. Let's go to some CBS News at the top of the hour. We'll be back.
This is Jack from the Warren Store wishing you all a happy and healthy holiday season and asking all of you to shop local, eat local, and visit local. The days ahead are getting darker and it looks like winter is finally here. Give yourself the gift of a stress-free life by shopping, eating, and visiting local. Visit your friends, businesses, and restaurants and support their passion and performance. I know that they would love to see you. The Warren Store, where funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
The Navy here for a long time.
We are back, and thanks for staying with us, folks. We are going into the second hour of our program for this Monday morning, December the 2nd, 2019. And my guest in the studio this morning is Judy Joy. She's executive director of the Good Samaritan Haven in Barrie, based in Barrie. They've now expanded into a couple of other facilities around central Vermont, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. The Good Samaritan Haven is a homeless shelter or a network now of homeless shelters, and they do important work making sure that as many people as possible, or let me flip that around and say as few people as possible are left without a place to stay, especially as winter approaches and these nights get very, very cold out there. Judy Joy, thanks so much for coming in this morning.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here. But I do want to make one small correction.
What's that?
I am not the executive director. That's Rob Farrell.
Okay.
He's my boss, an amazing man. I'm mm-hmm. the shelter manager.
The shelter manager at the Good Samaritan Haven. Okay. Glad to get that clarified.
I have more fun than he does.
Well, you guys can debate that. I'm sure he has. Everybody has more fun days and maybe slightly less fun days now and then. But anyway, Judy, first off, tell us a little bit about the Good Samaritan Haven. I gather it has been growing. I noticed there was a story in VT Digger the other day that actually brought this to my attention because I'd always assumed it was one place there in Barrie, and it made reference to, four facilities, right?
Yes. Yeah. The main house and on North Seminary Street in Barrie started 33 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was started by the members of the faith community who saw a need and decided to go with it. And so that house has been in operation with some changes in the building and some changes in the programming for about 33 years. A few years ago, maybe five, Heading United Methodist Church allowed us to open a warming shelter there in November, and they house 14 men.
Hmm.
And 3 years ago, well, this is the third year of operation, Bethany Church in Montpelier allowed us to open a 20-bed shelter in their social hall.
Hmm.
And they put in a shower, and it's a place where people who really would have nowhere else to be can come and spend the night. And we also have what we call a step-up house, which we fondly call Nest, because it's on the corner of Barrie Street and Nelson Street in Montpelier. And people who are doing really well in our programs at our main house can move on to there if they have a plan, if they have a job, if they have income and are able to move through, they can move on to there. And we have 13 beds there.
I see. Okay. And how many beds are at this original Seminary Street place?
30.
30. Okay. And you mentioned the one of them is, I believe, the Heading United Methodist Church?
Yes.
A warming shelter. Is that for the daytime? Or
no, it's night.
Oh, that's nighttime,
yep,
as well.
They open at 7 at night.
Okay.
Close at 7 in the morning.
And that's true of all of the shelters?
No. We're open 7 in the morning. We close at 7 in the morning,
mm-hmm,
open again at 3, unless the weather's really terrible, and then we can stay open all day.
I see. Okay.
And the one at Bethany opens at 8 at night and closes at 8:30 in the morning.
I see. Okay. Hmm. So there are somewhat varied schedules there. But,
yes.
But, if someone is without a place to stay and decides they need to make use of one of the shelters, do they just sort of show up there, or how does that work?
They do. Some people show up. Some people call.
Mm-hmm.
It's always good if they call, because then if we have room, we can tell them to come do an intake and put them where whichever shelter is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't call and show up and we don't have room, we feel really badly. So
yeah,
it's always good for people to call so we can let them know if we have room for them or not.
Right. I mean, are there sometimes situations where people show up and there's no room at the inn, so to speak?
There is, yes.
Wow.
Feels terrible.
I bet you, especially on a cold night, do you have a network of folks who are able to maybe provide just a very one-night stay kind of temporary situation?
We don't. Or? It would be a great idea if we could do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I know one of the domestic violence shelters up in Maine where I worked had that kind of thing. They didn't actually have a shelter, but they had houses that were willing to take people if they needed somewhere to be.
Yeah,
and it would be really great if we could do that.
Hmm. Tell me about what is the annual budget of the Good Samaritan Haven?
That's a Rob question.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't really know.
Mm-hmm. Do you know roughly where folks or where the organization gets most of its funding? Is it federal? Is it state? Is it charitable contributions?
We get federal funding through the State Office of Economic Opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Probably also get state funding. We get a lot of donations. The faith communities are amazing in supporting us. Some of the towns are amazing in sending us some money also because they realize that we're housing people that come from their towns.
Mm-hmm.
So the towns are chipping in. And we got a lot of donations from just amazingly wonderful, generous people.
Individuals and families,
yes.
Et cetera. Okay.
Yep.
I'm sure that's really important. Tomorrow, of course, folks, is Giving Tuesday, and a lot of organizations in our area. I think of the Vermont Food Bank, and Capstone is doing a Fuel Your Neighbor program. We're going to be hearing some about that on the WDEV tomorrow.
That's wonderful.
From Sue Minter of Capstone, and so it's that season, and be thinking about all of these programs that provide help to people in need. And certainly Good Samaritan Haven is one program like that here in central Vermont. And so it's it is a time to be thinking about generosity and all that good stuff. Let me ask you also, Judy Joy, the shelter manager. By shelter manager, do you operate all four of the shelters, or are you the manager for all four, or just the one in Barrie?
I'm mainly the one in Barrie.
I see. Okay.
Heather Tolman, who is our new program manager, is pretty much in charge of the other ones.
I see. Okay. And
each one of those shelters has a coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
Who schedules their staff and makes sure they have the supplies that they need, things like that.
The Digger story I mentioned, it was on Friday they ran this piece. Headline, I believe, was Vermont's homeless population is declining, but the shelters are full. And what does that tell you, right? Just that brief headline right there.
Well, it's a huge question because I don't understand how the homeless population can be declining, and we're still completely full most of the time. And I know that Barrie has a lot of programs happening there that people need, economic services, probation and parole, the court, things like that. So people come to Barrie for that.
Mm-hmm.
Montpelier evidently is stepping up and trying to deal with their homeless people problem by having a homeless task force. And, we just do what we can.
Yeah, it is. Tell me about the causes of homelessness from your perspective and from what you hear just from the people you talk to. I mean, I read media reports and I see a lot of just general discussion. And, one of the things you hear about is just the high cost of housing in general, that if you're a minimum wage worker, you can't afford an apartment in Vermont these days.
That's absolutely true.
Second cause of homelessness is folks who are not able to keep it together to go to a job every day and even a minimum wage job. And you end up, and oftentimes this is tied to addiction or mental illness or other problems like that. Does that account for half the homeless folks or most of them? Or
quite a lot of them, mm-hmm, actually are suffering from mental health issues and addiction issues, and some frequently both. We try to support people with hooking them up with Washington County Mental Health and counselors. We support them through recovery programs. We have in Barrie, there's I can't think of the name of it now.
Turning Point.
Yep. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And they're wonderful with,
yep,
helping with folks who are dealing with addiction issues. And there's meetings all over, good meetings, and
mm-hmm,
people go to those. And we try to support folks when they come into the shelter, if they're dealing with those issues.
Yeah, it's I'm sure it's not always easy. I mean, it's got to be just at a personal level, perhaps somewhat discouraging sometimes when you're dealing with addiction, and there's so much tendency toward relapse and that kind of thing that you think you've got somebody on a road to recovery and to perhaps getting their feet on the ground and so on, and then they're back in the same situation they were in a couple months earlier, How do you handle that?
But feeling worse about themselves.
Yeah,
really.
Because it's got to be discouraging for them,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, and I try to let them know that a relapse is part of recovery,
mm-hmm,
and that they shouldn't feel badly. They should just get back to their recovery programs.
Back in the battle.
Yeah. And it is a battle. It's really hard.
244-1777 is our local number here in Waterbury. 1-877-291-8255 or 291-TALK are the call-in numbers here at WDEV, FM, and AM. And if you want to reach us here at the Dave Graham Show, you are more than welcome to check in with us. My guest is Judy Joy. She's shelter manager with the Good Samaritan Haven based in Barrie. They now have a couple of facilities in Montpelier and I guess a couple in Barrie.
So, yes.
A four facility network of shelters for people who don't have housing. And it's a struggle out there, folks, for a lot of individuals. This, of course, is the time of year. Tomorrow's Giving Tuesday. If you feel so moved and want to make a contribution to the Good Samaritan Haven in Barrie, what's the best way to do that, Judy Joy?
They could mail it to 105 North Seminary Street.
105
in Barrie.
North Seminary Street in Barrie. Yeah. And what's the zip code?
05641.
05641. So, you know, and that's one of the, obviously there are multiple organizations out there these days doing fundraising efforts and so on. And, you know, you've got to spread it out a little bit, but that's okay. A smaller contribution to each one is better than, I would think, skipping a whole bunch of organizations.
Yes.
So
sharing is wonderful.
sharing is what's called for here, folks. And boy, you know, I don't know. I sometimes think when the holidays roll around and you're struggling to come up with ways to spend money on your family members and loved ones and so on, friends, and it might just be better to think about some of these organizations that probably are more needful than somebody you know, you want to give a small token to. And anyway, that's that is one way to look at the holidays. I know folks who actually will give a little card at Christmas and say, I made a contribution to such and such charity.
Yes.
Or even ask people, what charity would you like me to donate to? And that's one way to get the get this ball rolling here. You know, obviously I know our good friends out there who are in business in Central Vermont love it when you come in and go shopping, too. So there's always plenty to spend money on, that is for sure.
But, and a lot of businesses are really supportive, too.
Yeah, yeah.
But something happened a couple of Christmases ago that, when I think about it, just brings tears to my eyes.
What do you have in mind there?
There was a man, and he came in, and he had four small children with him.
Hmm.
And he had given them each a $100 bill.
Hmm.
And said that they could either keep it or they could give it.
Hmm.
And I don't think he made anyone feel guilty,
mm-hmm,
but they all gave me their $100 bills.
Wow.
And we got them to write their names in our gift book, and we sent them thank yous. But it was just so beautiful
that
to happen on Christmas morning for them to show up and do that.
That's tremendous, and certainly that's the spirit of giving. I think that the holiday season originally was probably most about, and
yes,
and it's something that really is could be inspiring. That's a terrific story. I love hearing some stuff like that. So, Judy Joy, you are how long have you been at the Good Samaritan Haven there in Barrie?
About 6 years.
And you said you were in Maine before that?
In Maine, I ran a shelter for men, women, and families.
Hmm.
And in Washington, D.C., I started in 1986.
Wow.
As a member of Lutheran Volunteer Corps.
I see.
And I did a volunteer year there. And then I stayed until 1992 when we moved to Maine.
Hmm. Whereabouts in Maine were you?
Ellsworth.
Oh, that's way up by sort of Bar Harbor.
The gateway to Bar Harbor.
Okay. The gateway. Yeah, that's a beautiful, yeah, beautiful part of the world up there.
Yeah.
But so you, it's interesting to me. Is this sort of a career that is common or rare for folks to get into working with the homeless? And
well, I don't know. We have some pretty amazing staff, so
yeah.
I think it's not that rare.
Mm-hmm.
I come come to this through my faith, mm-hmm. and I feel it's what I'm called to do. But there's other people who do it just because they love doing it, and they love the work. We've got a wonderful team at the shelter, and a lot of people come in the evening to be evening coordinators. We've got people who come to be our overnight staff. It's just, we have a great team.
That's a tremendous thing, and your faith is. I mean, I think of when I hear you talk about that, I think of lines like "I was a stranger and you took me in," and
yes.
that sort of thing.
Yep.
So you're a big believer, I'm guessing, in the Beatitudes and in the gospel, and that stuff. I don't know. It's weird, I'd say, in our current society and sort of political climate and so on. A lot of that stuff gets short shrift, I think, in media coverage and so on.
I think
that when you look around and you peel back even the first couple layers of the onion, you see that an awful lot of folks who are following different roles in life, especially where they're helping people, are motivated by their faith and it's not all about restricting people or wagging your fingers at people or whatever. A lot of it's still about that love that Jesus talked about, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Abundant welcome.
And of course, you know, the Good Samaritan Haven, the very name of the organization, speaks to that faith tradition of giving and caring and trying to really care maybe first or foremost for the less fortunate.
Yes, that's why we do what we do.
Yeah, do you find, you know, one of the things that is sometimes a tricky area is the speaking of faith and this kind of thing. Of course, we have a strong tradition in the United States of America of separation of church and state and that sort of thing. You do get some government grants and so on. Ever any areas you have to navigate carefully to try to avoid falling into this legal trap of government support for religion?
No, not really.
Mm-hmm.
I do what I do because of my faith, but the shelter isn't faith-based.
Mm-hmm.
It's open to everyone. Everyone is welcome. No one's excluded, race, religion, anything like that. So mm-hmm. I don't think there's that problem.
Yeah, interesting. If someone goes there, are they likely to hear from the staff anything like, you know, a sort of a, I don't know, a witness or a come to Jesus kind of a pitch or anything?
No.
Okay.
No, that I've never heard anyone do that.
Yeah.
Sometimes a guest will try to do that to another guest.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I usually try to remind them that if they're not there, that it might make them uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And sharing their faith is okay if they do it to people that seem comfortable with it.
Right.
But if people aren't comfortable with it, they shouldn't do it.
Yeah, that's a tough call. I know I've seen that in action, you know, in my own life with loved ones and so on who are caught up in strong religious faith and want to share that. And there's always a question of when can you feel like you're, I don't know, going too far or pressing it too hard,
mm-hmm.
and when is it okay? Do you have a sense that most of the people who are coming to the shelter are looking for, you know, a real fundamental change in their life, or are they just looking for a warm place to stay?
I think it varies mm-hmm. what their needs are, what's brought them to the shelter. No two people are alike. We meet them where they are and try to help them move forward. From where they are,
mm-hmm.
and depending on what their needs are, we try to help with the problems and with the needs.
Yeah, do you run into many cases where people may have been staying at the shelter previously at some point in their lives, and they've gone on maybe with that extra help that they got from folks at the shelter on getting their life together and starting to climb those first rungs on the ladder or whatever, they end up actually having, you know, a fairly stable, successful life later on, and that they then turn around and become your biggest boosters.
Yes, yes, that does happen. Hmm. It's wonderful to see that happen. And people who've moved through the shelter come back and support us in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We had a man who had a job but just didn't have enough money to move out. And he works in one of the local restaurants. And when we had our big fundraiser, he cooked wonderful food for us.
Hmm.
And it was just a pleasure to... He couldn't be there because he had to work at the restaurant that night.
Huh.
But
He prepared food for us,
and it was great.
That's that's another inspiring story there.
Yeah.
He's off working at the restaurant, and all you folks are enjoying the food. What did he make?
Yes.
What was...
Oh, he made some wonderful, wonderful dip.
Huh.
And, what did he call them? Some kind of bread with stuff on it. And
okay.
It was, I can't think, that was back in September, and
yeah.
I'm old, so I don't have a real good memory.
Okay, got it.
But yeah. It was wonderful food.
That's great. Hey, we have a caller on the line. Let's go to David from Worcester. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Dave. How are you doing?
Doing well. How are you?
Fine, thank you. I had the privilege of being the first director of the Good Samaritan Haven back in 1986.
Wow.
Wow.
I was there for 10 years
mm-hmm.
and have watched the growth of the Haven with great delight and joy, because I know from firsthand experience what it's all about.
Wow.
And I have a couple of questions for Judy.
Okay.
I've been out of the loop for a few years in regard to the administration and the policies of the Haven. And I'll mention three different areas, and you might pursue them, and I'll just back off and listen on the radio.
Okay.
Number one, how do you use volunteers, and what does it take to be a volunteer? Number two, of what requirements do, or what is the procedure to admit a homeless person to the shelter nowadays, and is there a limit on the time that person may stay at the shelter? And number three, I'm interested in the evolution of rules among the guests, in particular at the shelter. So if you could address those three areas briefly, that would be great.
Okay.
Let's start with volunteers, Judy. What do you...
Okay. We love to have people come volunteer. And people can come help us in the evening, serve dinner, help clean up. People can provide a meal, which is wonderful if they want to do that. A lot of local churches do that, or church groups, or families provide a meal. We have a meal calendar.
And is that part of your responsibility to
recruit those?
It is.
Yep.
Okay.
And so if people want to volunteer, they can give me a call. And our number is 802-479-2294.
Same number we had in 1986?
Yes. Things probably haven't changed a whole lot. We still have that little tiny office.
Yes.
We no longer allow the front porch to be piled up with stuff.
Good.
We have chairs on it. No, people can sit there if they want to.
So where do you pile the stuff?
That's when I can use volunteers to help me clean out the attic in the basement.
Because
there's a lot of stuff piled there. And we have an amazing group of people at the shelter as guests, and they do... They keep the house really clean and do their chores and, you know, do everything that needs to be done. But sometimes we need volunteers to, like, paint a wall or paint the door frames or do some extra cleaning or come with their pickup trucks and take stuff to the dump.
I hate to
interrupt. Like that.
But we need to go to a bottom of the hour break here for just a couple of moments. David, would you mind staying on the line? Because your questions are really good ones, and
okay.
I may have not gotten them all quite right. So
sure.
If you don't mind staying on for a couple of minutes, we'll go to some just a CBS Newsman, a couple of words from sponsors, and we'll be back very shortly.
Mm-hmm.
This is Jack from the Warren Store wishing you all a happy and healthy holiday season and asking all of you to shop local, eat local, and visit local. The days ahead are getting darker and it looks like winter is finally here. Give yourself the gift of a stress-free life by shopping, eating, and visiting local. Visit your friends, businesses, and restaurants and support their passion and performance. I know that they would love to see you. The Warren Store, where funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We're back. Conversation happening with Judy Joy, the shelter manager at the Good Samaritan Haven in Barrie. And on the line with us is David from Worcester, who tells us he was the first director of the shelter in Barrie, dating way back to, was it 1986, David?
That's correct.
And that's fascinating. Judy was telling me earlier that that's when the shelter started, and you're the guy. So, and I love making a connection like this on the Dave Graham Show here at WDEV. It's such a great community out there in Central Vermont. I've had people call up and, you know, talk via our show to an old friend for the first time in 20 years or whatever, and it's really kind of fascinating human connections we can sometimes, and it's completely accidental on my part. I don't usually plan for this stuff. In fact, I never do, but it's just a lot of fun to watch and listen to, I think. So anyway, you had a series of very good questions, and the first one had to do with volunteers, which I think I think Judy covered pretty well and just before we went on the break there. And then you were asking, I think, about stay limits, and I gather that is really refers to how long can people stay at the shelter.
Yes, that's part of it.
Okay, I can answer that. We try to be a program more than just a place for people to crash, to try to help people move through homelessness into independent living. And so for that, if people are willing to do the program and work the program, it's a 90-day stay with the possibility of an extension if they're getting very close to housing. People don't have to do that. It's not a commitment that they have to make. If they want to stay the 90 days, they do have to make that commitment. But if they don't want to, if they're just passing through, we'll give them a place to relax for a little while and send them off with clean clothes and food in their tummies.
Good.
And our good wishes. You also asked about rules. We have quite a few of those, and probably much the same as what were there when you were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
In our policy and procedure manual, we have the rules. And we really expect people to follow them, because frequently people have become homeless because of chaos in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to help them not have so much chaos by having rules and expectations and understanding that they'll get a lot farther in their lives if they follow rules and expectations. And so we do that. And we do expect people at the house to follow the rules. And if they have made a commitment to see the housing navigator, to be there for that appointment. If they've made a commitment to do their chore, to be there to do that. And to keep their spaces neat. And, you know, all that sort of thing. Just to help people have more structure.
Well, Richard, I'm sorry, David, I was writing down another.
Just to comment on what Judy just said.
Sure, yep.
Real quick. A part of it has to be for safety as well, don't you agree?
Absolutely.
Everyone wants to be safe in an environment.
That's important, sure, absolutely.
Very important.
David, thank you so much for the call. You raised some really good questions, and
sure.
I'm glad that you could touch base with us.
Definitely. Thank you. And I'm delighted to hear Judy's comments about her faith.
Great. Thank you.
All right.
You're welcome.
That's
keep
great.
It keep it up.
Love speaking with you.
I wanted to bring in another advocate for homeless folks here in Vermont. Elizabeth Reedy is based over in Addison County. She's actually a former state senator from there. I think that's how I first knew her, when I was covering the State House way back in the day. And for quite a number of years now, she's been involved with the John Graham Shelter in Vergennes and joins us on the telephone from her stomping grounds, as I mentioned, over there in Addison County. And Elizabeth Reedy, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thank you, Dave. Hi, Judy. How you doing?
Hi, I'm doing great. Thank you, Elizabeth.
And I thought the two of you would know each other, and sure enough, sounds like you do. And Elizabeth, I'm wondering, first off, refresh me on your role or title or however you describe it at the John Graham Shelter.
Well, I'm sure Judy probably agrees when you work at a shelter or with housing, you're pretty much doing a little bit of everything.
Lots of hats.
Yeah, yep. Lots of hats. You might be, we just put on a big Thanksgiving dinner for everybody in the community that, you know, we have five houses, and then we also have people that have gone on into permanent housing, and some people that might still be alone in their own new homes come back and celebrate. So, you know, it might be cooking a turkey, it might be cleaning a toilet, it might be on call, it might be helping somebody move. We take a slightly different approach in that, like I said, we have the five houses, and like Judy said, it's really important that people get their feet under them. So we feel that while they're with us, we really want to emphasize, let's take a look at what the issues are that caused homelessness in the first place. And so we have some service coordinators and also licensed clinicians on staff to really help people make a written plan, follow that plan, start going forward. And pretty quickly, they go from our shelter space, which are rooms, they're family rooms in most cases, not bunks, and then they go into housing pretty quickly. And then we stick with them when they're in housing. So, and we may stick with people for a very long time, because there's no reason for people to just be becoming homeless again. And like Judy was saying, there's a lot of reasons why people are homeless. And so we really try to get at the underlying reason. So.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that too, Judy, because you were mentioning talking about the 90-day sort of time limit that is, you know, the outside length of stay. It sounds like, but what about somebody who says is in the shelter for 45 days and then leaves and is you know, trying to follow a more hopeful path, ends up later on needing shelter again? I gather you welcome them back.
Yes, we do.
And. And does the 90-day clock start ticking then, or is it 90 days out of a year, or how does that work?
The 90-day clock would start ticking again, mm-hmm. probably.
Yeah.
Depending on what the needs were.
Okay.
And what caused the coming back. They needed to get their feet really under them again. The 90 days would probably start over.
Right, okay. And so that's really a decision made internally. That's not a function of, say, government funding or anything like
that.
No. Yeah.
No.
Okay. That's a judgment call made by the staff.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we have team meeting once a week and talk about these kinds of issues and, you know, really listen to each other, and because we all come at it with different experiences and things. And
Elizabeth, I was remarking on the fact that the two of you seem to know each other. I'm wondering, do you folks have statewide meetings and this sort of thing of an organization that get together and talk about best practices and then,
Yeah, there's Earhart, he has his group, affordable housing group, Earhart Monca, and mm-hmm. there's meetings through them, and there's also meetings through we have what we call continua of care, which are groups of people. For like Judy had mentioned earlier, there's a lot of teaming that goes on both in Central Vermont, Madison County, Chittenden County, where there are a variety of organizations. For example, in our area, we're very close partners with Women Safe, which is another group that works with people that are really trying to get away from domestic violence and other kinds of violence. So, or it could be the Parent-Child Center, where young parents are going to get support. So these continua exist on the county level, but they also exist on the state level. And so, yeah, there's regular meetings every month, sometimes too many of you.
I don't usually go to those.
Yeah.
Rob Farrell, our executive director.
Right.
Gets the pleasure of going to those.
I mean, they're good. They're excellent. You really do. And, you know, the other thing is that of course, we really serve a lot of local people, but also we do take people oftentimes. I mean, we're right up against Central Vermont and Chittenden County and Rutland County, and also the Kingdom, which has fewer shelters and places for people to go. So we take people from all over Vermont, but primarily Addison County, because when someone becomes homeless, it's really great for them to remain in an area, especially with families, where there's some family support and they're, you know, they know people in the community. We find that almost everybody's working in the shelter itself, and of course in the housing. So it's good for people to remain local.
Judy, do you find that as well, that most of the residents in the shelter these days are working?
Not of our population.
Okay.
Yeah,
because you've remarked on that in the past, Elizabeth, that that most of your residents do work, and I just, you know, that it's a little bit. I mean, not so much anymore, because I've heard it enough times, but it's a little shocking still to think about somebody who is actually out there working 40 hours a week or whatever and applying their
it shouldn't be shocking though, Dave, because stop and think. All right, in Addison County, the average house. Average apartment would be about $1,000 for a modest apartment, mm-hmm. and you know what minimum wage is. Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at the housing wage, in other words, how much would you have to make in order to pay for that average house of $1,025? In Addison County, it's about $19.75.
Yeah,
roughly, give or take, depending on. And so a lot of people don't make that much. And not only that, we have somebody right now who rides a bike in the snow to work 3 miles every day and is making minimum wage and doesn't get 40 hours. So people are really working hard. And, you know, I said, you can't keep riding this bike in the snow. I mean, but he's dedicated to the job.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. And I mean, you know, riding a bike in the snow is I've seen some people do that around Vermont, and it's not an easy thing. But if you think about the housing costs on a low wage plus transportation, I mean, I don't know how that person would afford any kind of a car and insurance and registration and upkeep and all that stuff that you're going to be facing with a car. So it sounds like the bicycle is the way to go, maybe.
Yep. Well, he did have a car, but then, of course, something goes on the car. And a lot of Vermonters that have housing and jobs are one incident away from being homeless. They may, if their car goes, they may end up missing work. They may end up losing that job. If a child is sick, any one of these kinds of incidents can really trigger people to enter into homelessness. So we just want to make sure that when they come, we help them get into permanent housing, and then we stick with them so that as these obstacles arise, they aren't alone when they're dealing with them.
That's really important.
Yeah, it is.
One thing that I think a lot of people probably don't think about, but, you know, it's a pretty common thing, I think, in just the people out there in general, at the end of a work day to come home and maybe have a beer. You don't do that at the homeless shelter, right?
Well, I'll let you go first.
We don't expect you to do that.
Yeah.
And we do breathalyze when people come in.
Mm-hmm.
But if the number's low and their behavior is fine, we'll have them have supper and go to bed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If the number is high, dangerously high, then we'll call and try to get them some more assistance. And if their behavior is obnoxious or annoying or dangerous, they have to leave. Hmm. And that's a choice they make.
Yeah, that's tough. What about your situation, Elizabeth? You run into that much?
Yeah, well, I agree with everything that Judy said. I mean, we are really working with people on issues associated with substance use.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, we do have, you know, licensed clinician, master's level people there because we really want to address why people are homeless But on the other hand, we also like to follow the Housing First model, which basically says it's really tough to deal with an issue, for example, like a mental health issue or physical health issue, an addiction issue, if you're homeless. So, you know, with five facilities, we have some ability to get people inside and then begin to work on those issues. I mean, we have gone out a few years ago. We had an outreach worker that went out and reached out to a pretty middle-aged person living by the banks of the river with a very serious alcohol problem.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, bring them in because they're not going to make it for long in those conditions. You know, you can't live forever like that. It's really hard on people. So, you know, yeah, I agree with what Judy said earlier about the rules. They're important, you know, because you want everyone to feel safe.
Yeah, you want that's the bottom line is safety first, and then and everything else follows from that. Now, Elizabeth, you mentioned you have five facilities. They're not all in Virgins, right?
One in Middlebury, four units, each of which are pretty good sized units, and then we have a big house also in Bristol.
Oh wow! Okay,
hey, Dave, I want to tell you. Do you remember when I was on your show? Was it a year ago or something?
I'm sorry. Say again.
Do you remember when I was on your show about a year ago? Was it a year or so ago?
Yeah, about that. Yeah, it was definitely late fall.
There was a young man on with me, a dad with a number of children. Well, he got a job as a result of that show, and he had that job for a year, and then he moved on to another one. But I just wanted to tell you,
wow.
You know, I'm not making this up about people working. People want to work.
Yeah. They do. They really do.
Well, and I'm glad to hear you. If the show helped him at all to land employment, that warms the cockles, you know. That's
it does.
That is that's awesome, you know. And I was saying earlier that we had a call from a gentleman named David from Worcester who turned out he was the founding director of the Good Samaritan Haven in Barrie.
Yeah, I listened to that. Yeah.
Yeah, I just love the connections that we can sometimes make through this radio program here. It's kind of it's not something that was first thing I thought of when I started here, and I'm discovering that it's a communications show, and you know radio is a communications medium, so it kind of makes sense that it's a place where the community does connect, and I love that aspect of it. So to hear you say that somebody was on the show. Went out and got a job as a result.
The employer that was on the job hired him.
I'm sorry?
The employer that was on the show with us hired the person. Remember that we had Matt Barong from Three Squares?
Wow.
You know, he was hearing about what a hard worker he was and how he worked all these jobs on these farms, and then the next thing you know...
That's
worked out well.
That's a great story.
That's awesome. Well, you know, whatever we can do to help folks make the needed connections out there is a banner day for WDEV and the Dave Graham Show here. So it's a good thing.
Yeah,
hey, Elizabeth, what do you see as the? I'm going to ask the two of you in the few minutes we have remaining here to give your own versions of the answer to this question. What are the most important policy changes that you would like to see either at a statewide or federal level to improve the situation for Americans who are homeless? Elizabeth Reedy, I'll start with you.
Okay, well, the deep down issue has to do with the disparity of income. I mean, you can go on, if you want to see what the disparity is in Vermont, you can go on, what's that... is it Common Assets? Is that the name of it? And it talks about how the income disparity has grown wider and wider. And what ends up happening when that happens is people get discouraged. There's not really a way for them to get out. You know, somebody that's riding 3 or 4 miles a day in the snow to work at a fast food place, you know, that's pretty grim, you know. And people, we need to have some policy changes that will kind of reverse this trend that we've seen with the rich getting very, very, very wealthy and the poor just destitute. Other than that, if we're not going to get at the real roots of the issue, then we need to provide services along with shelter and housing so that people can begin to work on some of the issues. But, you know, poverty, it can be really tough to work with when the system kind of systematizes it, you know, when the incomes keep pulling further and further apart. So I think that, if we're only going to continue to go with blinders on, we've got to provide people the services. We can't just have them going from one shelter to another. We've got to give them vouchers. We've got to give them services. But way underneath that is the disparity of income.
Judy Joy, what are your thoughts on this?
Absolutely. I agree 100%. And I think along with the income disparity is probably the lack of, I think people see, people who don't have see the haves not contributing, yes, not having higher taxes, not paying their fair share. And then they don't have what they need because there's other people who have way more than what they need. And that's really hard. It's really hard for people to see that. And I think folks get really discouraged and sort of give up.
Yeah. I think it's behind the unrest that we see in our country, too. I really do. You know, people feel that, I mean, even a lot of these angry people that you see on TV doing horrendous things, and I'm certainly not ever, ever, ever forgiving any of it, but you can't live in a culture where there's such huge disparity and so many people that are working hard aren't getting ahead. That's got to change.
Yes.
That'll change if we want to continue to have our sense of community and our sense of decency as a nation. We've just got to change. So.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Elizabeth Reedy of the John Graham Shelter in Virgins and I guess elsewhere in Addison County as well, and Judy Joy of the Good Samaritan Haven in Barrie, you two have been terrific guests and really raising important issues here on the WDEV's Dave Graham Show. Hey, I really appreciate you joining me,
Dave,
this morning.
Can I just put in a quick plug for our sleep out this weekend?
One last thing, sure.
Okay. So we're sleeping out on December 7th. Above the falls in Middlebury, and we're raising funds for our programs and for our shelter. It's www.johngrahamshelter/sleepout, and it's going to be a really cold night. So if everyone would keep us in their prayers, that would be great. It's going to be snowy and cold.
Wow, okay.
Bless you.
Bless you, and hang in there. Elizabeth Reed. Judy Joy, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
That's about it for the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV. Stay tuned for Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre, and we'll be back with another edition of our program tomorrow just about 9:05 a.m., and we'll talk to you all then. Have a great day, everybody.